Today on Against the Grain, employers regularly check the background of potential workers for criminal records, even though the claims that such checks predict their diligence or trustworthiness are dubious.
People who have been criminalized and or are coming out of prisons and jails are often highly motivated to work. They work really hard to get the jobs, and if they get the jobs, they tend to be the people who show up, who go to great lengths to keep the job, who take whatever shift is given to them, and who work really hard and stay till the job is done. Among the employers in my study that I spoke with who had long histories of hiring people with records, that was their observation.
Anthropologist Melissa Birch reflects on what caused the shift and what vested interests maintain its ubiquity. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. If you're a job candidate or a potential tenant or even a volunteer, it's now commonplace to be subjected to a criminal background check. While it may appear that background checks are a long-standing part of hiring, criminal history used to be regarded as private. In recent years, there have been efforts to remove the checkbox from job applications that ask if someone has a criminal record, but such practice is still widespread. Melissa Birch is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of Michigan and the director of the Afterlives of Conviction Project. She's the author of The Criminal Record Complex, Risk, Race, and the Struggle for Work in America. Melissa, can we quantify how common it is for employers to check the criminal records of potential or even current employees?
This is obviously a number or percentage that's quite difficult to estimate with precision, right? And scholars have tried to get at it in a variety of ways. But the most reliable way is to ask job seekers themselves, right? Studies using a variety of methods, including asking job seekers directly about the last time they applied for a job or had an interview, continue to show that the vast majority, again, it's hard to put a number on, but let's say 80% or more of employers now conduct criminal background checks as a matter of routine. I can't really estimate precisely how many conduct background checks on existing employees, but that is certainly becoming more and more prevalent as a practice to conduct continual background monitoring, even after someone has been hired, and certainly when someone is applying for a promotion or to move to a different department, there's often an additional background check at that point as well.
So in other words, it's very widespread. What is the legality of using criminal background information in employment decisions?
Well, that is a big question. And that is because there are a number of laws that sort of get at the legalities of this in different ways. But I would start by saying at bottom that nothing in the law says an employer can't run a background check and use the information to inform their hiring decision, right? So the various laws that we have dictate sort of when and how the information can be used and the process that must be followed. So just to lay out a couple of the laws, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, right, says that a credit reporting agency cannot report arrests that don't lead to conviction or convictions that have been granted dismissal by the courts or convictions that are older. Here I'm speaking specifically to California where my research was conducted. Convictions older than 7 years from the date of conviction. There's also the Equal Employment Opportunity Guidance, right? So the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission published a revised guidance on the use of criminal records in 2012. And this guidance is based in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, right? And so prohibits employment discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, national origin, sort of protected categories. And so it's only by extension that it also protects people with criminal convictions. based on the demonstrated link between discrimination on the basis of race or national origin and criminal history. In other words, the fact that Black and Latino people are overrepresented in rates of arrest and conviction means that if you discriminate on the basis of criminal record, there is a high probability that you will also be discriminating on the basis of race and producing a disparate impact. And so to avoid producing those racial effects, the guidance prohibits blanket exclusions such as no felonies, right? You can't just say we don't hire people with felonies. And instead, employers are required to conduct what's called an individualized assessment, right? So looking at what the person was actually convicted for, taking into consideration the nature of the conduct and how serious it was, how much time has passed, what rehabilitation they may have undergone since the conviction, and as well, crucially, of the nexus, as they call it, between the nature of the conviction and the job duties, right? So there has to be some relationship between what the conviction was and what the job requires. Then you have this additional layer, you know, in some places, and this is uneven across the country in different jurisdictions, but we have ban the box policies in 37 states that delay consideration of criminal records to some point later in the hiring process, right? And so again, in California, where there is a very strong such policy, the Fair Chance Act of 2018 sort of bans the box and goes further, also requiring public and private sector employers with five or more employees to delay asking about criminal convictions until after a conditional offer of employment has been made. In other words, there are sort of a whole set of laws that cover process, what kinds of things can be considered, when they can be considered, and requiring employers to give notice to applicants that they are going to conduct a background check, as well as time to contest what is found in the background check and to present evidence of rehabilitation. So all of this has to do with process. But at the end of the day, employers still have tremendous discretion to decide that that conviction record is somehow in conflict with the job and that they do not want to hire someone on the basis of that record.
So given all of that variability, unevenness that you just mentioned, can we generalize, though, about the impact that such policies have on workers, especially workers with criminal records, as they find themselves in the job market and are looking for employment?
Absolutely. Well, I would say, yes, to some extent we can generalize, and in other ways we cannot. And I'll say a little about both. So in general, people with convictions, especially convictions that are felony convictions and are recent convictions, have unemployment rates that are very high, close to 30% is the current estimate, right? And also, those who do find work tend to earn significantly less than people who have similar levels of education and do not have criminal records. There is a demonstrated impact both on people's ability to get work and then also on kind of immediate and lifetime earnings as well. So also people with records often are locked out of opportunities to advance to higher levels within the same profession or workplace. I think we can also generalize that there are deep psychological impacts to this, right? You know, workers with records report, you know, feeling incredibly discouraged. It's very demoralizing to be repeatedly rejected for jobs for which, you know you are qualified and highly motivated to do. And then this is where I said it's also varied. It's hard to sort of just talk about workers with records or people with convictions because, of course, there are all sorts of different kinds of people who have convictions and different kinds of workers, ranging from people who, you know, never had a job prior to their conviction to people who had full-blown careers that they now can't go back to because they work in an industry that prohibits people with felony convictions from being in that industry, or the previous employer won't hire them back. And so part of what I explore in the book is that while the impact of a criminal record is, deeply detrimental and sort of damaging to everyone economically, it's important to remember that the experience does not, in fact, land everybody in the same boat. There's huge variation in terms of what impact the conviction actually has. The other piece is that I think it's important to not think about workers only as individuals, right? So there's a huge social impact to this. People with convictions are part of families that they provide for and who must provide for them if they can't provide for themselves, right? They are members of our communities. They are taxpayers, right? So the impact of someone not being able to get a job has a huge ripple effect on children and broader communities that I think we often don't think enough about.
There's a, I think, a widespread assumption that people with criminal records will be unreliable employees, maybe even problematic employees. What is the reality?
You're exactly right. There is sort of baked into the legality of this and the rules around this, the idea that someone with a record will necessarily be a problem in the workplace or poses a risk to the workplace, right? That's the sort of rationale and justification for the myriad exclusions that we see. The reality, in fact, seems to be, to the extent that it's been empirically demonstrated, is quite to the contrary. All of the studies that have sort of attempted to assess in some sort of big way what kind of workers with records are, have shown the opposite. Again, that people who have been criminalized and/or are coming out of prisons and jails are often highly motivated to work. They work really hard to get the jobs, and if they get the jobs, they tend to be the people who show up, who go to great lengths to keep the job, who take whatever shift is given to them, right? And who work really hard and stay till the job is done. Among the employers in my study that I spoke with who, had long histories of hiring people with records, that was their observation. They either observed that there was little to no difference between employees who had criminal records and those that didn't, or they observed a correlation between being a good worker, being a dedicated worker, and having a conviction record.
What's supposed to be gleaned from a background check, at least according to those who promote them? What do they think they will prevent or learn about candidates from that information?
The idea of a criminal background check is that past behavior predicts future behavior, right? So if we look into the past and see what someone has done, a record of behavior, right, is what the criminal background check is supposed to show, a record of decisions that someone has made, right, then we will be able to predict what they will do, what they are likely to do, what they may do in the future. I'm not a criminologist, but criminologists have shown that that link is shaky at best, right? Crime is highly time, place, and context specific. So just because someone did something in a particular context at a particular moment in their lives does not, in many cases, accurately predict what they're going to do in the future. But there is that sort of ingrained assumption that that's how we know what people are likely to do in the future is by looking to the past. And I think the other piece of that, the other assumption embedded in the background check, is the idea that that record does, in fact, represent a comprehensive record of behavior, right? So if I don't have theft on my criminal background check, then that means I have not engaged in theft. If I don't have a DUI on my record, that means I haven't ever driven while under the influence, right? So there's this idea that the record accurately and fully captures what each person has or has not done, right? A record of who has done what. When in fact, I would argue that it is simply a record of who has been criminalized for what.
I'm speaking with Melissa Birch. She's director of the Afterlives of Conviction Project, author of The Criminal Record Complex, Risk, Race, and the Struggle for Work in America. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So background screenings obviously constitute a constellation of professions that either make money or otherwise benefit from their use. And I wonder if you could tell us what they are, because it certainly goes well beyond the companies that provide background screenings and the employers who you just mentioned.
There are many nodes, I would call them, to what I have called in the book the criminal record complex. And these are, I think of sort of the entities, the institutions, the motivations that are involved as either benefiting directly from this idea that people with criminal records are dangerous to employ, and or simply having playing some role, right, in promoting or driving the use of criminal background screening. And so some of these interests or forces are sort of more direct and obvious, and others are less so, right? So I think, yeah, I mean, it's easy to focus on companies that make money from running background checks. That's an obvious node. But I think it's also important to look at the way the legal structure, which has, for example, enacted, you know, tens of thousands of statutes that exclude people with convictions from working for public agencies or under government contract, and in particular industries and professions, right? So, you know, early in my ethnographic research, I started to encounter all kinds of job seekers who had been working in particular professions and industries and then could not go back to the specific thing that they had been trained to do and had already been doing and were good at doing because of their criminal records, and because an employer was sort of discriminating against them or didn't want them to work at that establishment, but rather because something in the law, whether it was an occupational licensing law or some other statute at the state or federal level that prevented people with felony convictions from working in that profession. So, for example, there was a woman who I met who had been training to be a CNA. She had been working in home health care prior to her imprisonment, and the home health agency she was had been working for certainly wanted to hire her back. Old clients were anxious to have her back as a care provider. But because, you know, the California Board of Nursing doesn't allow people with recent felony convictions to qualify for the nursing license, she had to, you know, wait a period of years until she would be able to go back to that profession. And there were so many examples like this that led me to see how the law itself is a key element of this, right? And this is reflected in the American Bar Association's compilation of the tens of thousands of consequences of conviction nationwide that they've compiled in a massive database, showing the many, many, many statutes that bar people with convictions, and not only from employment, from all sorts of access to resources, benefits, and civic participation. To just keep going with the law, another complex part of this, right, has to do with the way that the scope of employers' liability for the actions of their employees has been expanded since the 1950s, right? So people may have heard of a doctrine called negligent hiring, under which employers began to fear that failing to conduct a background check might expose them to financial risk. And this idea that as an employer, I might be responsible for the behavior of one of my employees is a huge driving factor in employers' reluctance to hire people with convictions, right? If you are fearful that you may get sued, and as these lawsuits have become bigger and bigger to the tune of multi-millions of dollars, an employer could theoretically, although these cases are quite rare, but theoretically, my business could be bankrupted if I hire someone who I know has a particular criminal record, and then something bad happens on my watch. Another I'll mention is that I encountered early in the field, as soon as I, started talking with business owners, hiring managers, managers of staffing agencies, right? Many, many people mentioned that they would be open to hiring people with convictions, but their insurance policies didn't allow them to hire people with conviction records. And at first I was somewhat skeptical of this claim because obviously this could be sort of a way to hide behind one's own biases or prejudices, right? But investigating this further, I learned that in fact, insurers' use of criminal records as a factor in underwriting goes way back to the period, right after World War II, when insurance companies began to promote these sort of low-cost bonds that would protect employers from fraud, theft, or embezzlement, or other sort of dishonest actions of their employees, and stipulated in those bonds that employment be denied to anyone with a criminal record unless the insurance company specifically exempted them. And this use of criminal records in the insurance industry has only grown, of course, as access to criminal records has proliferated, right? So now that criminal records are sort of widely and easily accessible, insurers, unlike in the past where they had to rely on companies or the employees themselves self-disclosing that they have a criminal record, now, it's possible to check everyone to see if they have a criminal record. And thus, the use of criminal history data and its availability online has allowed these firms to increase their use of it in assessing risk.
Well, maybe to illuminate the other aspects of it, I wonder if you could give listeners a sense of how data for background checks is actually collected and then transmitted. Like, how does it get gathered up and where does it go along the process where which might end up with a potential employer?
The vast majority of criminal record data is produced in the courts where these matters are adjudicated and settled. And court records are and have always been a public record. But again, it wasn't until the records began to be digitized and then available online that more and more people could have access to them, right? So in the prior to the internet, to the digitization of these records, if you wanted to know what had happened in court, the outcome of a case, what someone was charged with, whether or not the case, whether or not it resulted in conviction or dismissal or whatever happened, you had to physically go to the courthouse and know in which county that case occurred, and either go yourself or pay someone to go for you to retrieve that individual record, right? So obviously this is a very time-consuming and costly practice, and that is why criminal background screening was reserved for, positions that were considered very special, positions of public trust, positions where someone might be working unsupervised with sensitive or vulnerable populations, right? But it was not a practice that was practical to do for every single job, for every single employee. With the digitization, again, of these records and the increasing demand for background checks, courts eventually became overwhelmed by the number of requests that they were getting to produce background information for various individuals. And so began to batch this information, right? To sell batches of the data to third-party vendors. So, yeah, without getting too into the weeds of this, you know, most employers do not themselves conduct background checks, right? They hire a third-party screening company to do this work for them, because it is difficult and it is quite technical, and you have to know how to get this data, how to sort through it, how to make sure that you're only looking at the data that you're legally allowed to be looking at, all of that. And so there's a role for someone to translate that raw data that's in the courts to the kind of user-friendly, understandable data that employers can actually make use of in the hiring practice. And landlords as well. Any end user needs sort of some help to go between the raw data and what we call a consumer report that kind of is a more packaged version of the conviction record that is usable in the process.
Melissa Birch, it might come as a surprise to listeners that until the 1970s, the consensus at the state and federal levels was that criminal history was private and should be protected. So some might conclude that the change now, the fact that we now have widespread checking of people's backgrounds for criminal records, is something that kind of just evolved naturally, or perhaps was the product of technical change. You mentioned digitization of records that allowed for the dissemination of data. Why don't you think that either of those explanations holds water?
The ubiquity of criminal background screening that we have today, running a background check as a matter of routine on every new employee, it's absolutely true that that would not be possible were it not for digitization and computing power advances and the internet. So it's precisely this ability to compile all of this data and share it around quickly and easily and cheaply that makes it possible to have the system and the current practice that we now have. Still, though, I argue that we can't attribute too much, or, you know, too much to just what is made possible by technology, that too easily lets us off the hook, because it is also our choice to, and our motivation to say, I want that information, I want to use that information, right? And to demand that information and to, right? So the background screening industry rises to meet a demand, right? People are asking for the data. And so I think it's important to, and this is what I attempt to piece together in the historical chapter of my book, sort of how the motivation for this, to have access to this data, grew over time and for what reasons, right? And so I think we have to think kind of simultaneously about capacity, right? And what's possible, as while at the same time thinking about motivation, right? And crucially, the value that people attribute to this information. Because as we were discussing before, if people were not convinced that this data were valuable, that it provides this crucial window into who is a risk and who is not a risk, who's a good person, who has poor moral character and who has good moral character, right? If we weren't generally convinced that criminal records illuminated those things, then there would be no market for it, right? And so I think it's important to try to piece together the many ways that at different moments in time there have been driving motivations that get met with increasing capacities and in many ways produce what we could call kind of a perfect storm, right? Where all of these in some ways unrelated threads and elements are coming together to produce this effect that is bigger than the sum of their parts. But what I try to lean into in the book is the places where we have made deliberate choices, right? That go beyond sort of a perfect storm kind of analysis.
I'm speaking with Melissa Birch, author of The Criminal Record Complex, Risk, Race, and the Struggle for Work in America. She's assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. Well, then let's turn to the history that got us to the place that we are now with the ubiquity of criminal record background screening. What's the origins? What are the origins of criminal records in the first place? That is, in the United States, from what did they originate?
Yeah, I think because I had been thinking and researching and witnessing for so long the use of criminal records sort of among everyday people in employment contexts, I almost had to remind myself that criminal records were and still are first and foremost a tool of policing, right? So the original motivation for having criminal record repositories and databases was, of course, to assist police, right? If they arrested someone in one place, they wanted to know whether that person had ever been arrested or was still wanted for a crime in another place, right? So the desire to sort of improve and integrate policing practices is where those motives began to create databases. And then I would say once the databases were created, many other people began to take an interest in them, right? Of course, other people in the criminal legal system, people who work inside prisons, right, found criminal histories, very useful for knowing, you know, the people under their control, devising treatment plans, right? So there were many kinds of professionals working inside and outside of the legal system who took an interest in this kind of record. But it originates in policing and then begins to take on other lives and find other uses.
You write in your book that the political repression of the McCarthy era and in the broader context of the Cold War, along with how professionals were licensed, played a role in the history of record keeping about people's criminal pasts in this country. How did that happen?
I'm not a historian, right? So I am a historically oriented anthropologist. The purpose of this genealogy for me was not the archive, right? Or to try to really understand this history for its own sake, but rather to make sense of how we came to be in this situation in which most employers wouldn't hire someone with a felony conviction. So it is my understanding that, you know, under President Truman's loyalty program, that program, which initiated widespread background investigations of government workers, that prompted large businesses and professional organizations to kind of follow suit, right? And, you know, I found very interesting, right, this idea that this is kind of the first time that turning to background checks became sort of a key way for a business to demonstrate that they were on the up and up, right, that they're not harboring organized crime, that they are legitimate organizations, right? So this idea that I can show my business or my organization is a legitimate one simply by conducting criminal background checks on all the people who work here, right? And this period also then moved, in addition to just kind of doing this widespread background screening in private organizations and businesses, as well as across government agencies, this prompted entire industries to begin to pass regulations to exclude people who had criminal convictions from their ranks, right? Again, to kind of demonstrate we don't allow people with records in our organization. There's also, as you're mentioning, this trend of occupational licensing in the United States, which is kind of an issue of labor economics that is apart from the issue of criminal records, right? So it's its own story of occupational licensing first surged in the United States at the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, in professions that were related to health and law, right? But then again, there too, following World War II, there was another big surge in sort of the number of professions that required a license or a special credential to practice in them. And it's my understanding that there have always been, sort of since the inception of occupational licenses, the boards that allow someone to become credentialed or licensed in a given profession have always had a criteria around criminal conviction, right? So it's always been part of getting a license has always involved checking whether someone has a criminal record, or at least asking about it before people were able to actually check. So what's happened, though, is that as the number of occupations and professions that require this kind of special license or credential have grown, right? And they've grown exponentially since the 1950s, right? In some states, as many as 30% of professions now require some sort of special license or credential. So as we've seen that increase, that means that by extension, so too have the share of jobs for which people with criminal records cannot qualify increased, right? So this is sort of an indirect effect, but a phenomenon that's happening parallel to, that isn't necessarily specifically about the exclusion of people with criminal convictions from the workplace, but produces this effect.
Well, as we noted earlier in the program, you know, a change came in the 1970s. And I wanted to ask you about that, but also in the context of leading up to it, the Black freedom struggle, because race plays a disproportionate role in this story about the human impact of these criminal records and their screening. Out of the Black freedom struggle, there were urban uprisings, there was increased surveillance by the U.S. state of protest movements. How did that shape the shift that took place in the 1970s? Would you relate the two of them together, or what is that broader context or understanding? What then happened to shift the expansion of criminal records as a way of assessing somebody's trustworthiness or reliability?
I mean, I think there are a number of connections we can make. You know, a concrete one is the establishment in 1968 of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, right? And so that was a federal program within the Department of Justice with the aim of funding state and local initiatives to improve law enforcement. And this was kind of important to the development of the infrastructure that we have today, this influx of monies to localities to improve policing practices was very much part of, and this impetus to sort of professionalize policing activities led to the creation of a lot of the infrastructure that makes criminal background screening possible. The databases, the integration of the databases, the centralization and storing of records and sharing of that information that was largely motivated in this period where there was this focus on policing professionalization. And then I think there's also just the general shift that we know happened around this time from an emphasis on rehabilitation and reintegration to an emphasis on punishment and retribution and risk-based assessment and exclusion. Criminologists talk about this sort of broad shift toward risk-based or actuarial practices where we are no longer thinking about how do I treat and reintegrate this individual, but rather how do I figure out who the risky people are and the not risky people and ensure that the risky people are contained and managed and monitored. And I would say that this period in the 1970s is kind of the beginning of that broader shift as well in criminal justice thinking and policy. Because, going back to your question about privacy as well, right? If your goal is to reintegrate and rehabilitate people, then that's in direct conflict with having criminal records be widely available and accessible online, right? That stands in direct conflict with the goal of successful reintegration, because it marks people with kind of a stigma that they can't escape, right? And makes reintegration that much more difficult. So all of these sort of specific shifts that we see happening on the ground also take place within these sort of broader ideological and practical shifts that are happening in society at the same time.
Obviously, there was that orientation toward being tough on crime that you discussed, but I wonder if you could talk about how September 11th and the war on terror expanded the world of screening people for criminal backgrounds.
So the attacks of September 11, 2001 unleashed, I would say, sort of a tidal wave of fear and prompted the single biggest surge that has ever happened in state-mandated criminal background checks. So, within just a few weeks of the attack, the Federal Aviation Administration ordered criminal background checks for 1 million workers who had secure, access to the secure areas of airports. Similarly, the Patriot Act mandated all employers who were involved in any way in hazardous material transportation to conduct background checks on more than 3 million employees. And then we saw, new laws around airport workers, airline personnel, port workers, truck drivers. So just millions of new background-related restrictions and laws pertaining to industries that had not been industries in which background checks were required previously. So there was that kind of direct and immediate impact. And this extended, of course, to the ports and maritime facilities, right? So there's all these new background checks that are quite suddenly required by law. But then I think more broadly, right, there's also just the general culture, right? The general sort of climate of fear and sort of cultural moment post 9/11, when again, this kind of spillover effect from the government mandates is that everyone sort of who is in a position of power, whether they be an employer or a landlord or the head of a nonprofit organization, right? There's a general sense that to do due diligence, criminal background screening should be embraced. And this general idea that if you do a background check, you can sort of do your part in making sure that the bad guys don't get into your organization. And so I would say like that spillover effect is what sort of prompted this massive new demand, right, for background screening. So suddenly, lots of people who had not been doing screening before wanted to do screening, right? And thus prompting, and this is what sort of caused more hundreds of new background screening firms to get into the market and start trying to meet this demand.
Melissa, you have been talking in the hour both about, well, the costs of background checks to, many workers and the society at large, because nobody exists in a vacuum. People are connected to other people. And then, in a way, the way that criminal background screenings emerged and all the entities that play a role in these screenings and hence have a vested interest for this expansion of background screenings, the ubiquity of background screenings. So, given all of that, I wonder if you could end by telling us what efforts you see that have been mounted to challenge discrimination based on criminal records, and also what openings exist, if there are, for workers who find themselves looking for work and run into the possibility of just not being able to find work because an employer decides that they just can't take a chance on them.
There are many, many efforts around the country to challenge as well as to work around and shift the landscape of sort of thinking about this issue. I mean, the first and sort of most well-known, I'm sure that listeners are familiar with, is the Ban the Box and sort of subsequent Fair Chance hiring movement, which has been incredibly successful in just kind of raising the basic idea that a criminal record should not forever define someone, that the past should be allowed to be forgotten, that people should not forever be stigmatized and discriminated against based on a conviction, right? So I think just that that very opening to say, hey, this is maybe not the right way to be thinking about this. I think we're in a moment in which that idea is generally understood, right? At least there is people understand that maybe that's not fair, that's not just, that's not not useful. I think where there is still more work to be done is that sort of despite that general understanding that criminal background screening causes, perpetuates and further marginalizes communities and individuals in ways that are very detrimental to some and not productive for any of us. Despite that sort of general understanding, people still continue to face pretty significant barriers in looking for work. And despite the legal challenges that have been mounted, the Fair Chance policies that have taken root all over the country, there are still, in many cases, employers who are now acting within the law, but still somehow finding ways to deny jobs to perfectly qualified candidates. And so I think what I see happening and what's encouraging is that not only are there, many campaigns around the country to further enhance and strengthen and enforce the laws that do exist to protect the rights of workers with records. There is also kind of, again, this continuing shift in the sort of ideological battle over, those things we were talking about earlier, like what do we even think a criminal record means? Is this information really indispensable? Are there other ways of vetting candidates? And as more and more employers have done pilot programs, more publicly started hiring people with convictions and having success. I'm sort of hopeful that those tides are beginning to shift and that more and more people are seeing that this kind of knee-jerk exclusion is counterproductive at best.
Melissa, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Melissa Birch is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of Michigan, Director of the Afterlives of Conviction Project. She's the author of The Criminal Record Complex, Risk, Race, and the Struggle for Work in America. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.